Welcome to the Babbelry,
where translators visit the Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel.
Babel.
Babbelry.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. Sandy Stone first told me her story of being TERFed when she suffered through a vote to exclude her from a women's community when I interviewed her in 2023. My first reaction was indignation. How dare they exclude Sandy? Since then, I've talked to a number of women on the other side of that divide, women who were concerned about the inclusion of transgender women in women's groups, and my understanding has deepened. It's not that my opinion shifted, but that I now have a wider view of what happened. The person who offered me the clearest counterpart to Sandy's story is named Nancy Vogel, and unless you are knowledgeable about the arcane details of 1970s women's music, no, she's not famous. In fact, Nancy's first question for me was, "Why do you want to interview me?" By chance, I'd gotten to chat with Nancy when she called me about using music from her band, the Berkeley Women's Music Collective, in an episode featuring writer Joan Gelfand's memoir of the movement. I was impressed with Nancy's thoughtfulness, and not surprised that since setting her music career aside, she's worked with youth. She was sensitive, open, and eager to tackle tough questions. When I told Sandy I'd spoken to her, Sandy's response was, "Do you know what she did to me? And do you know that she called me to apologize?" This is a story about a transgender woman and angry women who wanted to exclude her. It's a surprising and beautiful story, told by women both characterized by a deep love for the community that nurtured them. I hope you can listen with a heart as open as theirs were when they spoke to me.
I first became aware of the women's movement in Santa Cruz because some women started coming in to the stereo repair shop that I was running on the mall.
This is Sandy Stone, who arrived in Santa Cruz County in 1973, looking for a safe community where she would transition her gender.
And they turned out to be lesbians and part of the what we called the women's community, which included both lesbians and straight women. And at that point, there were about 50 women that constituted the women's community. So we could all see each other. You could put us all in one room, which made it very cozy, actually.
It was everything. It was everything. It was everything. You know, everything. We took on everything because everything was an exploration out of necessity.
That's Nancy Vogel. Nancy arrived in Berkeley to join a nurturing community of radical feminist lesbians.
The contradiction and the juxtaposition between the vision that we had for ourselves as experiencing our full potential and the limitations of the stereotype of what, quote unquote, women were supposed to be at the time. And that juxtaposition, I think the contradiction between those two roles for women in society just spurred everything. And so it created this truly just an exceptionally unique confluence of history, kind of human experience, where you have these moments where that confluence comes together, the people, the place, and the theory.
It's hard to overstate how powerful this time was for women who didn't fit the mold. Lesbians, radicals, trans women. Sandy didn't seek out the community, but she was ready for what it had to offer her.
Sisterhood. Comfort, mutual aid, good conversation. Speaking as a trans woman, I'm not sure that I can describe this well, but there was a sense of bonding that I called sisterhood.
Nancy sought a place where she could find comfort in being the person she was. I'm a mother and teacher, so hearing her description of her realization that she was a lesbian just tears my heart out.
The big part of the contradiction for me is that I knew that that was pond scum. I mean, I knew that, you know, I was the evil, you know, despicable soul of the world.
In order to learn to love herself, Nancy had to find other lesbians, and that happened in Berkeley.
I moved into the Derby Dyke House, which was the old governor's mansion. So it had 12 or 13 bedrooms and a pantry and a ghost, by the way, which is probably another story, but about 12 women lived there. And so I moved into the pantry at $40 a month.
Meanwhile, Sandy was in Santa Cruz hosting the queer community in her shop.
From the viewpoint of the women's community, it was a time in a way of carefree bonding over dances, over dinners at various people's homes, over the Wizard of Oz, my store, which really became kind of like the GLBT community center.
Sandy readily points out that as soon as she transitioned, she easily passed as a cisgender woman. But for many lesbians, passing had never been comfortable.
For those of us who are on the butch side, it was exhilarating to be able to just wear jeans and boots and flannel shirts. And I mean, I know it's a trope, you know, about lesbians and flannel shirts, but it was really true. We got to dress in the ways that we had maybe envisioned, but never felt free enough to do. You have the psychology of sort of the liberatory feeling of being released from oppression. And so then there's a set of principles that go along that and emotions that go along with that. And so then you experience it, you experience the exhilaration.
Like Sandy, Nancy found comfort in the women's movement, but unlike Sandy, that comfort was juxtaposed against a very different experience as a woman in the world.
And then you reflect on what caused you to have that. So then there's an anger and a rage that emerges, because then you realize the resentment that you were not allowed to be this person. So that fueled a lot of the anger. So that I would say, it sounds trivial, but it's really not. We were all being who we needed to be for ourselves. And in doing so, it liberated also our vision for what we could create in the world.
As prominent as the issue of transgender rights is now, in the 70s, it was literally unthinkable. The word transgender hadn't even been coined yet, and very few trans people were open about their identity. Sandy says that even in the lesbian women's community, people didn't have a preconceived idea, at first at least, of what she was.
I don't think anyone had any idea what trans really was. I had the advantage, and it's a considerable advantage that to this day I'm very grateful for, that I was very passable. I went from definitely being a dude to being a passable woman without very, very much intervening time. And that meant I was protected simply by being invisible. And we could talk about trans without really knowing anything about the political firestorm. It would become lighter when everybody had to take sides. And
Sandy calls that first period of her time in the women's community stage one, because what came next was quite different.
And then there came a time when we get to stage two, which is when some of the radical separatists in town decided that I was not a woman. And they brought that to a head, and we actually had a meeting at which the purpose of the meeting was to decide whether or not I was a woman, and therefore whether I could be allowed into the community. And as it turned out, there were two separatists in town who were making all the noise. And of course, now we know that a minority of, I'll bless them by calling them radical feminists, so I don't think they are, a minority is extremely loud, and they look like there are more of them. It's like some bird fluffing out its feathers to look more threatening. And when it came down to it, we actually took a vote. Is Sandy Stone a woman or not? And it was 2 against 48. And that was the last we ever heard of that.
Nancy explains that women in her circle were heady with the idea of exclusion. At that point, they needed to assert themselves as women first and foremost. That feeling permeated everything they did, from women's bookstores and cafes to women's music.
I was sort of in my super arrogant separatist phase where I said, well, why do I have to learn a bunch of stuff that German men did 100 years ago? I mean, that was my concept of music theory, right? I had no idea that it was a language that allows you to communicate with other musicians. Like, that didn't dawn on me at all. So it was pretty excruciating because we would say, well, take it from where it goes, dut, 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 and then it stops. Let's put a rest right there.
Nancy had joined a band called the Berkeley Women's Music Collective. Only one of the women in the band, Nancy Henderson, had any musical training. Here's how Sandy remembers it.
Berkeley Women's Music Collective was great. There were these boisterous, just bumptious young women with very low musical skills, but great determination. And my job was to make them sound like they could play. And I think we all together did a really, really good job. And I went back recently, and someone sent me a vinyl of the album, and it was actually a lot better than I remembered it being. And all props to them, because they were working very hard in a completely novel environment.
You've been listening to the Berkeley Women Music Collective's most influential song, The Bloods. For Nancy, the band wasn't just about music. Its meaning in her life was much, much deeper and wider.
The thing about the collective that I will value and treasure for the rest of my life is that it was about the music, and we did play music, but it was about interpersonal communication, accountability, social responsibility, integrity, honesty, support, absolute support. And those things are what the collective really was about, teaching us how to be exemplary teammates, supporting each other with dignity.
The anger and rage that women had been feeling came from the trauma that they had experienced individually and collectively. And the healing was coming, Nancy says, from this idea of exclusion. So when her band heard that they would be recorded by a woman who had been successful in the testosterone-filled world of rock and roll, they weren't just excited the way any woman today is excited to hear about another glass ceiling being broken. They were coming from a place of trauma.
Exposing trauma was a huge part of the movement. I mean, I think Sandy's one of the most brilliant, one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. And the sad thing is that some of the controversy about Sandy was not that she was a trans woman. It's that there was, you know, when you never see anybody who is the model of what you think is possible. It's like, we never thought that a woman could record Crosby, Stills, and Nash. It's like, what? What? How did she do that? That's impossible. You know what I mean? Like, how did she do that? And so a lot of it was this disappointment that when we see somebody who personifies the vision that we see, there's a kind of an idolizing that experience or that person or the personalization towards that experience. And so it wasn't really about Sandy. It was that Olivia waited so long to, you know, to share that information that there was a sense of betrayal.
For Sandy's part, she was deeply enmeshed in the women's community and Olivia Records, and it didn't occur to her that she needed to out herself to the band.
I did not know that anyone who knew anything about Olivia did not know I was trans. I made absolutely no secret out of the fact that I was trans.
Yet the women in Nancy's band didn't know. And when they found out, it didn't go well.
After we did the Berkeley Women's Music Collective album, it turned out that one of the women in the collective did not know and was scandalized and thought rather badly of me as a result of it. And consequently, later, at an Olivia meeting with some women's community in Oakland, I found myself in a position of being opposite this woman whom I had thought of as a pleasant acquaintance. And she was standing on a chair screaming at me about how dare I ruin the women's community and on and on like that.
That was Nancy, who reacted from a place of grief and, she now admits, deeply hurt another person who had no idea why she would be so angry.
I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I mean, now I wish it were totally different because Sandy had a miserable time. But I think that's a lot of what happened, is that there was a sense of betrayal because we were so delighted to learn that she could exist, you know, that that could exist. And so it's been a mess. It's just been a mess. The whole thing has just been a mess.
For their part, Olivia took that experience and others as indicating that there were women in the community who were stridently anti-trans and would remain so.
I think this was a big wake-up call for all of us. I think this was a point when Olivia and whatever we represented, having our nose rubbed in collectively, rubbed in the fact that there was a whole other women's community that did not share our values, not only did not share our values, but didn't want us to share our values, didn't want us to have our values.
Nancy remembers it differently. She was present in the rooms where women opened up, when women found out over and over that they were not alone and that men had been more widely abusive to girls and women than anyone had previously suspected.
Women were getting together, speaking with each other, learning how to be vulnerable, learning how to share, and learning how to receive support from other women. And the shocking thing that was emerging is that so many women that we knew were in women's groups, and suddenly incest and molest began to emerge in the dominant culture. And at some point, we could hardly name a friend or another who hadn't been in some way violated by a man in their family or some other way. And I'm not saying that's the only reason, but I'm saying it was so prevalent that it was shocking. It was shocking to all of us.
I asked Sandy to reflect on what she thought was the reason for TERFs, trans-exclusive radical feminists, and her view isn't too far from Nancy's.
Okay, this is an individual view, just mine. These women seemed to me to be damaged, every one of them. They had been hurt, and of course, 90% of women are at one point or another sexually harassed. I felt that these women had been sexually harassed and hurt and possibly raped and assaulted and made to feel so powerless that they had to take that rage out on someone. And here we are with targets on our backs. We were, in one definition or other, we were men.
One thing that I learned from Nancy is that radical to her didn't mean angry or violent.
Radical feminism in all the women that I knew and all the touring that we did and all the creating that we did of a new, kinder, gentler culture, it was based on liberating all humans to grow and experience their highest potential without violence, without fear of violence, and with appreciation for the potential of their humanity.
But how to understand this vision of all humans living without violence coming from someone who screamed in the face of a very vulnerable human and told her she didn't belong, shouldn't even exist? That's the hard part. And understanding trans-exclusive radical feminism today, in light of all that has happened and all the knowledge we now have, is even harder. Sandy suggests that part of it is that transgender people are not a monolith that can be easily explained.
And there are some trans women who accept that identity. Yes, I lived part of my life as a man. I had male privilege. I gave it up in order to be able to be who I felt I really am. And then there are other trans women who say, no, I was never a man. Even though I was living as a man, I was never a man. I was really a woman inside and was just waiting until I could fix that, which is just a way of saying we're a very diverse community.
But Nancy focuses on the aspect of trans people that we explored earlier, that they simply weren't a known quantity in the 70s. And in fact, as Nancy tells it, many lesbians continued to feel uncomfortable with trans women in the interceding years simply because they didn't understand how to fit them into a world that was very precious to them, a world that for a time had excluded men.
I think what happened is that that became, other people reacted to that, who hadn't had a chance to dialogue and talk about what their fears were or what that meant or what does it mean to women's movement or what does it mean.
As a member of a most vulnerable demographic, a transgender female amongst lesbians, Sandy saw it differently. She was held up alone as someone that didn't belong in the community she loved.
We were facing up to the fact that it didn't matter what we said. We were being told who we were by a group of women who felt they knew better than we did who we were. I don't know really why at that moment both the lesbian feminist movement in the good sense and the beginning of trans women in that community and this enormous backlash of hate from a very small, very loud group of people just happened to happen at the same time.
When I think of the intervening years between the mid-70s, when Sandy and others were TERFed, and 2015, when transgender people suddenly exploded into our political and social conversations, I see a sort of long, pregnant pause. Most trans people during that period did not transition publicly. Often if they did transition, they made a break with their old life and didn't make waves within the queer community. From the perspective of the wider culture, as lesbian and gay rights made a slow, steady march forward, trans rights hovered in the background. Until suddenly, to people not involved in the movement, the demand for trans acceptance seemed to be everywhere. That seemingly sudden coming out, though it didn't feel sudden to trans people, coincided toxically with the left's new emphasis on the policing of language. At the same time, large numbers of formerly apolitical people were activated by a new movement that was seizing on trans visibility, MAGA. Nancy says that lesbians didn't have a problem specifically with accepting trans people. She'd done that. As a counselor to queer youth, she came to understand the struggles of trans people. She'd called Sandy to apologize for her behavior and felt that she was making amends. But the policing of speech, she felt, left lesbians in particular with a lot of unanswered questions.
We weren't allowed to talk about it. I saw the silencing. I saw it. I felt it. You weren't allowed to ask questions because you weren't allowed, I say air quotes, you weren't allowed to have those discussions because they were so threatening, maybe, or for whatever reasons, people assumed that they were antagonizing or pejorative, even though they could have been tenderly exploring. We weren't allowed to do that.
Nancy sees this time through the lens of her experiences in the early lesbian community, but Sandy sees it differently. She says that the important split that happened was not that trans people were asking for acceptance or denying anyone the right to discuss trans issues, but that the right had always had their eye on any vulnerable minority to use as a wedge. And just as trans people were making waves, from Caitlyn Jenner to the trans influencers on social media, the right found their wedge. And like any wedge, once wielded, it doesn't stop at the surface.
When you look at it from a strategic way, starting with trans people, or in particular trans women, is a brilliant tactic because it then opens you up to going after queer women because they're different, and then going after women of color because they're different, and then eventually going after white women, which they will, and which I think we can all see coming now.
Was it the policing of speech that caught the right's eye? Was it that trans people were seeking easy access to rights that lesbian and gay people had diligently worked for over generations? Was it sports and bathrooms and surgery for minors? Sandy says that the trigger is not nearly as important as addressing this crisis. And part of the solution, she says, does reflect the experience of lesbian and gay people in the 70s and 80s. What is important is the need now for transgender people to come out of the closet, walk on the streets, and put their humanity on display.
There are people who have never seen a trans person. They only know the propaganda they hear. How do you counter that? You counter that with greater visibility, but not on the national stage, because that means nothing. You have to do it door to door. You have to do it by showing up at public meetings. You have to do it by being visible in the streets. As dangerous as we may think that is, or as dangerous as it may be for individuals, it's death either way. So which one are you going to choose? The one with the chance of moving forward, or the one with no possibility of moving forward? That's one of the grim realities we have to face. That's the way the world works.
Just as lesbian and gay people did by coming out to their families, by asking for equal rights in areas like hospital visitation and benefits, by pushing their issues to boardrooms, school boards, and the local public sphere, Sandy exhorts trans people to do the same. And Nancy says that we shouldn't put too much weight on the exclusionary part of the movement that nurtured her.
It was an evolutionary period, is what I want to say about it. It wasn't a political strategy that we decided would be successful forever. But at its time, it was crucial for the healing of women, because the women's movement, it was about healing each other such that we could emerge from our own community and walk with integrity in the dominant culture.
It's important for all of us to remember that what we see as predetermined in history never was. History was built by people who had no idea where the future would go. Sandy remembers the heady nature of the women's movement that embraced her, even while a small minority tried to shun her.
It was that oh my God moment when people began to realize what was actually possible and the power that women actually had to make positive change in their own lives, in the lives of women around them. It was palpable. You could see it. You could feel it. You could practically smell it.
Nancy Vogel didn't remain in that place where she screamed at another person out of pain and confusion. She grew inside, and she embraced moving outward into the wider community.
At some point, I felt like, okay, I feel pretty strong now. I'm healed now by this movement. And I think for the most part, everybody just really wants to be in the mix of the real world with diversity and, you know, difference of opinions and different experiences. And so I think being in the mix is really where people want to be. But that separation, I think, is a crucial, and I don't want to say phase because it sounds so pejorative, but I want to say it's a crucial evolution of people's strength and authenticity, maybe.
As a transgender woman, Sandy Stone had to be tough. She knew that she had been invited to join in something special when she found the women's community, and she treasures the work she did with the Olivia Collective. She also treasures the time as an example of how people can embrace change, learn to love in new ways, and help our culture move forward at least a little bit toward the vision of radical love that the women's community shared.
It was an absolutely amazing time. There is no gainsaying that. And being just fortunate enough, but no other reason than that I happened to be of that age at that time in that place, I got to watch something truly amazing that I won't get to see again in my lifetime, and I will not forget it. It was glorious.
Thanks to Sandy Stone and Nancy Vogel for their thoughtful, open conversations with me. I started this inquiry into the arc of trans acceptance with a feeling of heaviness, a fear that our culture will get stuck in this ugly space we're currently in. But perspective is a fine salve for many wounds, and I leave hopeful that we can continue forward, fighting a fight that never ends but changes shape as we communicate, understand, and grow. We don't necessarily have to agree with each other, but we do have to find, somehow, a way forward with respect for our shared humanity. People like Sandy and Nancy give me hope that we can.
I sat down on the of me down.
The Bloods was by the Berkeley Women's Collective, engineered by Sandy Stone. The song Floods is by Pretty Swans, and Lonely Blue, Holy Blue is by Patricia Taxon, both on Bandcamp. Thanks for listening.
Singing out that loves me. What do I do when the light gets changing? What do I do when it stays the same? What do I do when we all lie down? And what do I do when the floods come down? How should I cut my hair next time? And where do my hands go when I cry? What do I do if the tears don't come? Words come out, how do they sound?
You've been listening to The Babblery.
The Babblery is produced with support from KSQD Radio in Santa Cruz, California.
Find us on major podcast platforms or at babblery.com.